Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Software bills of material. Everyone knows that somehow they're crucial to cybersecurity. But deciphering these documents, known in the vernacular as S-bombs, has been a challenge for many agencies. The Silicon Valley Innovation Program aims to help. It's part of the Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate, and it has a program to promote development of what it calls supply chain visibility tools. Joining me with the details, the managing director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, Melissa Oh. Ms. Oh, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And we also have its technical director, Anil John. Mr. John, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what's going on here. Maybe a little bit of background on the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, and then we'll get into what you're doing to help agencies with this S-bomb conundrum. I guess you have to read S-bombs and nobody knows how to do it.
That's right. Well, thanks, Tom. Really glad to be here. And the Silicon Valley Innovation Program within the Department of Homeland Security's Science and Technology Directorate is focused on working with the startup community and identifying problems that they can help us solve by baking in some of the pain points that DHS has into the commercial products that they're developing. And so by leveraging the other transaction authority, we're able to more quickly reach the startup community and get them under contract quite quickly and get them working on some of our hard problems within DHS.
Yeah, Anil, tell us about S-bombs, because it sounds like a great idea. Read the ingredients and you know what's in your software. But in fact, these are complex documents. There could be thousands of components in a given software program. And there are competing, I guess, standard languages for expressing S-bombs. Fair to say?
Very fair to say. I'll start with the last piece first. There's a very famous cartoon that is out there that is prevalent in the standards community where there are competing standards. And then somebody else comes in and says, hey, we need to have one standard that sort of unifies all of them. And now we have three competing standards. So I want to start out by saying that what we want to do here is not that. We do not want to create a new standard. There are actually two very mature standards in the SBOM space called Cyclone DX and SPDX that targets different communities, but are both considered SBOM standards. And as you noted, Tom, SBOMs are very similar to the nutrition labels on food. It provides an indicator of what goes into software and identifies potentially things that are vulnerable that you need to be updated. And we want to sort of ensure the interoperability and the broad acceptability of that through our work here.
Yes, they're like food labels, except it would be a food that has 10,000 ingredients in some cases.
More in some cases, open source components, closed source components, and a variety of other things pulled from a variety of places. So that is exactly why we need visibility into the, for lack of a better word, the supply chain of software before it is deployed within a government network.
Sure. Those ingredients, there's more in software than there is in, say, Doritos, you know, so it's a really a long list. And Ms. Oh, then these companies, what will they be doing? What are you seeking from these companies in this effort to organize the reading of S-bombs?
As Anil set up, the need for the ability to translate between these two standards is important in order to ensure the broader adoption of S-bombs across enterprises and other organizations. And so our cohort of startups developed actually an S-bomb translation tool called Protobomb, which has now been launched and is now openly available through the open source community at OpenSSF through the Linux Foundation. So we're really excited. They announced that just last week at Open Source Summit, and it's available for everyone to start to adopt.
We are speaking with Melissa Oh. She is Managing Director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, and also Anil John, Technical Director of that program at the Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate. And is the overall goal then to maybe abstract for a given agency practitioner the S-bomb, which is this big document, and such that they can apply some of these new products that you're having developed to an S-bomb and figure out what the S-bomb is telling them, because maybe there's only 10% of it that might be of concern in a given package?
I think that is spot on. It's more along the lines of agencies or organizations or even tool builders should not need to worry about the format and the standards that are being used for SBOM. But if by using the protobomb that Melissa mentioned, they have the ability to sort of, you know, automatically translate that and sort of ingest it without having to worry about all of that. And to your point there, the projects that we are funding the protobomb piece is an artifact that is going to be baked into all of the capabilities that we are funding. For example, like visualizing SBOMs, the ability to sort of visualize software right within the SDE, right within SIEM products, and show connectivity to like vulnerabilities and things like that. That's the high level piece that is really important, because SBOMs by themselves just show you what is in there, but it doesn't directly tell you if something is vulnerable or not. So the products that we're building and having our companies build are actually doing that connectivity, and protobomb abstracts and sort of makes the translation war go away, or the format war go away.
And it sounds like it does this in a situation that is context sensitive. That is, if you're in your SIEM program, you need one view. And if you're maybe, I don't know, in acceptance or runtime type of situation, then you need another view.
That is absolutely correct. You know, we fully realize that obviously different entities within an enterprise need to look at this, whether it is a developer that is building software, having it directly visible within their software IDE, whether it is a system administrator having it visible across the enterprise, and somebody who's sort of looking in a software in general and what the assets that they have, having the ability to visualize that as well. So all of those capabilities are something that are being built out by the cohort of companies that we are funding. And underneath the covers, all of them are also baking in the protobomb translation software into their products, such that basically they don't have to worry about the format that the SBOM comes in.
Right. And by the way, protobomb only has one B in it, correct?
That is correct.
Make sure we get that spelling right. And Melissa, tell us about the programmatic aspects of this. You have multiple vendors involved in the protobomb effort. How do they get along, and what's the intellectual property sharing piece of all of this from, you know, again, the project standpoint?
So as far as the companies are concerned, they're working collaboratively together as a cohort. Their IP is their IP. They're contributing to the open source. They're developing their own products and tools and solutions independently. But because they're pulling in protobomb, they work collaboratively together. And so they're doing great. They just finished phase one. They're all entering phase two. And by the end of phase four, they'll have solutions that are completely commercialized and available for acquisition by government organizations or commercial enterprises. Many of them are actually commercializing their existing product suites now. And by the end of phase four, they'll have fully functioning commercial capabilities.
And it sounds like the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, one of your maybe partner components at DHS, could be a channel for getting this in front of individual agencies, since they do that with so many other types of cyber concerns.
Absolutely. CISA is our partner in this project, and they've been advocating for the work that we're doing with the companies as well. And so we're working very closely with Alan Friedman, who I'm sure has been on the pod before. He's definitely a great advocate for what we're doing here.
And what is delivered is a usable product, a application that is already compiled and has an interface, and people can say, shove their S-bombs in and get some wisdom out of them. Anil?
I think, you know, the model of SVIP is absolutely that. At the end of the phase four, there should be a product SKU that is available in the market that agencies can buy and the broader community can buy. In this particular case, obviously, there are two tiers to that, right? So there is the products themselves that the companies will have that basically may be add-ons to software IDEs, may be add-ons to SIEM products, may be add-ons to visualization software that people can actually acquire and buy. And obviously the piece that is fully documented, open source, available under a license that both open source as well as closed source companies can leverage is the protobomb, which has now been accepted into the OpenSSF, which is a pretty big deal, because then you got, you know, global eyes on it, maintainers that are going to be supporting it, contributing and the like, that is going to have a life of its own and maintained, you know, going forward as well.
In other words, the protobomb is kind of like the engine about which people can build all different types of vehicles.
I think it's too much to say that it is an engine. I think it is definitely a critical part of an engine that basically, you know, provides the entire capability more than anything else. And the critical part it's providing is basically not having to worry about the different formats of SBOMs that are out there.
Right. So the final question to you, Ms. O, is the demand signal from agencies. both in DHS and maybe around the government that, great, we're getting S-bombs, but it's like somebody dumping a load of hay on us, and it's really hard to rationalize what it is that's in front of us, this big pile.
That's right. I do think that by having these capabilities, the executive order that was put out will make it much more simple to be able to achieve some of the requirements that are out there in terms of cybersecurity and software supply chain visibility.
Melissa Oh is Managing Director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Program. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Anil John is Technical Director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Project. Great to have you with us.
Absolutely. Great to be here. Thank you.
And both at the Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate. And they'll be demoing the protobomb and related products during the week of May 21st in Alexandria, Virginia. We'll post this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work
now. Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies. And we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor and I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.